Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Allen. I'm joined this segment by a very special guest. Senator Gary Peters is in town, and he's generous enough to come in and stop in our studio for this segment. Senator Peters, welcome to Copper Country Today.
Well, it's great to be with you, Rick.
I appreciate you coming into town. We're a little bit out of the way, of course, for a lot of people to make their way up here. So what brings you to this neck of the woods?
Well, of course, as a U.S. Senator representing the state of Michigan, I need to be in every single corner of the state. So whenever I'm back from Washington, look forward to having an opportunity to crisscrossing the state, meeting people, talking to folks. I take the job of being a representative very seriously. That means you have to be in the community. You have to be out listening to folks and talking about issues that matter to them. So the last few days I've been here in the Upper Peninsula, been in Escanaba, had a number of meetings with business leaders, local elected officials, did the same in Marquette. In fact, we had a real nice meeting, a roundtable on forestry issues and what we need to do to expand the harvest of wood products here in the Upper Peninsula, as well as a number of other meetings. And now I'm be heading up to Isle Royale to talk to the Park Service about some of the challenges and opportunities for a great national park.
Get their wolf and moose study all sorted out, hopefully.
Yeah, in fact, that's one of the main things I will be doing is talking to Dr. Peterson, of course, a great researcher when it comes to the wolf moose relationship from Michigan Tech here, and we'll be going through some of their ideas. But we definitely like to move that process along, as you're well aware. There are only three animals left, wolf on the island, and we need to bring in some more to have some genetic diversity, and you just have to work through the process.
Right, and that's, you know, we've covered that story a number of times here on the news, and you know, our listeners are like, okay, well, if the wolves die out, that's fine. Why do they need to be wolves in Isle Royale? It's not the wolves that are the problems. It's going to be the moose, because
right.
There's not going to be anything left to check the moose population there, and that could have devastating effects to the ecology on the island, with basically a runaway moose population that's going on.
Right. In fact, I think it's doubled from what I understand. So I'll have more details at some point in the future, but it has expanded dramatically, eating the vegetation. Then you'll have a moose population crash, but it's not the right balance, and we know we can do better.
Okay, looking forward to it. Let's talk about some of your recent items of legislation that you've introduced and been a part of. I've been reading about your commitment to veterans, yourself being a veteran, and those issues that are important. Can you talk about those?
They are. I mean, veterans issues are always very important, and my office works, and I did when I was in the U.S. House, so worked aggressively to make sure the veterans got the medical care that they have earned, and they certainly deserve to get into the VA. As you're well aware, we had issues getting folks into VA. We continue to have some issues, but it's getting better. But one issue in particular that I've picked up and have introduced legislation and working on a bipartisan way to get this legislation through, I have two of my Republican colleagues, Senator Daines and Senator Tillis, joining me. And that deals with veterans who may have been discharged in less than honorable circumstances, either a general discharge or a dishonorable discharge, and it's a result of some behaviors that they may have engaged in while they were in the service. But then later it turns out that some of those behaviors were related to post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injuries, combat-related changes in behavior, which happens. And we're certainly much better at diagnosing those invisible wounds of war than we were in the past. But still, it often goes undiagnosed till later for someone. And we're finding that some veterans who may be suffering from depression and other kind of changes in behavior, which is a symptom of post-traumatic stress disorder, may have led to a discharge. And then later it was diagnosed that they indeed were suffering from this disorder. So unfortunately, if they were discharged in that way, they don't have access to the VA. They don't have access to the treatment for this disorder that arose out of their service to their country. So the legislation says if a veteran has verifiable medical evidence, and the VA certifies the medical evidence is indeed there, and it's true that this particular service member does indeed suffer from PTSD, for example, then their discharge can be changed, and they can get the treatment they certainly earn and deserve. This is, in addition to having bipartisan support, I've got the VFW, the Disabled Veterans of America, other veterans groups have all endorsed this legislation, because sadly, it happens more frequently than we'd like to admit.
And this is one of those items, when I read them as they come across my desk, I'm almost taken back. How could this possibly not already be, you know, a law? How could we not already be taking care of our veterans who have been diagnosed with, you know, these traumatic results of their service. And so it's glad to see if that is in the process of getting fixed. Where does that stand right now?
Well, right now, we've introduced it. It's before the committee for the Armed Services Committee. Hopefully, we'll be able to take it up in the fall. You know, I've had conversations with folks who seem to be willing to work with us. And the fact that it's bipartisan, you know, we've got, there's three of us, myself, and then two Republicans have joined me. I think certainly helps to bring it to everyone's attention. You know, the only pushback I've gotten from folks is they're saying, well, this is going to probably cost some money. And I'm saying, yes, it will cost some money, but we owe it to our veterans. It's a sacred obligation that we have as citizens of this country. If we send men and women into harm's way, that they know they're going to be taken care of if they come back and they have injuries. And that doesn't mean just the physical injuries, but also the invisible injuries that we have with some of these disorders like PTSD.
Sticking with veterans legislation. Now, if I'm recalling correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, but you served in the reserves, correct?
I did, yes.
Okay. Navy. So someone who is working and they're serving in the reserves, they often have a situation where when they're called to active duty, they could be faced with a financial difficulty because they're no longer at, you know, what may have been a better paying job than what they're going to be paid when they're, you know, in active duty. Now, you have a piece of legislation that's meant to address part of that. Actually, it's a continuation of credits, if you can explain that.
Yeah, it is. It is an issue where we have men and women who serve in the reserves and then are called to active duty. Many times their civilian pay is more than their military pay when they're called. And of course, if you have a family and obligations, the bills keep coming in at the same rate. And if you're getting paid less because of your military service, that can put a strain on your family back home. Not only is there a strain that your mother or father or wife or husband is away from you, but also the income problems. And so what many larger companies do is they'll pay the difference. If you work for a big company, they'll pay the difference between what the military pays and what they will pay. But it's difficult if you're a small business owner. You know, business owners have a little tighter budgets than you'll have with a big Fortune 100 company. So the legislation says if you're a small employer having 50 or fewer employees, and you decide, it's up to the employer to do that. If they decide to pay the differential, there'll be a 20% tax credit applied to the business owner. So it helps the business owner make that difference up to that service member. It's a continuation of what we've done in the past. We need to continue to do it. We still have folks who are called up to active duty. And that legislation now is put into a tax extenders package, which is moving through the Senate. Hopefully we'll have a chance to vote on that. I think it'll come to the floor for a vote when we get back in the fall.
Yeah, I appreciate that as well. My son is in the Army Reserves.
Oh, wonderful.
So, you know, very proud of his service.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Wonderful.
Well, a couple of things I can mention on behalf of local veterans here, because I know, you know, meeting with a number of them working in my job, they often bring up, you know, desires to first have a veterans cemetery here in the UP, which we'd love to see happen. And also because distances between where veterans live and where they can get care is so hard, so long, being able to get more access to care locally and still have it covered by their VA benefits. But these are probably things you hear to as well.
Yeah, I do. And certainly all that is something we need to address. Especially the aspect of having veteran benefits to make sure that you can get it of a VA facility. If you live in the greater Detroit area, for example, you're close to a VA hospital. If you're in the Ann Arbor area, you got a VA hospital. If you're in the UP, it's a lot more difficult, but you still should be able to get the services that you have earned and therefore having an ability to go to see private providers but still covered under VA benefits is very important.
We touched briefly about, you know, with your extending the tax credits for small businesses. So let's go back to small businesses in general, since you've been also concentrating on that, promoting small businesses, especially here.
Yes. In fact, I had a number of meetings with small business owners as I've been here in the UP. And whenever I travel around Michigan, it's always part of my agenda. It's a very important one. Most of the job creation in the country, and same here in Michigan as well as the Upper Peninsula, is our small business owners. You know, 70% of all new jobs are created by small businesses. So we need to make sure that those entrepreneurs have the resources they need and are able to be successful. When they're successful, we're successful as a community. But a big part of my focus in that area, in fact, I serve on the U.S. Senate Committee on Small Business and Entrepreneurship, so it's something I deal with regularly, and focusing primarily on resources and loans and the ability to get the money. If you don't have capital, you can't start a business, you can't grow a business, and it's sometimes very difficult for a small business. So working closely with the Small Business Administration, SBA 7A loans to extend that program. Also, I authored when I was in the House the State Small Business Credit Initiative, which provided resources to economic development groups focusing on small businesses. And the one here in Michigan was money to the MEDC, who was then involved in a lot of really innovative, creative programs to help a small business owner have access to capital where private banks may have been a difficult place to go. And yet they had a good business plan and had a good business. And sometimes it's just that their collateral wasn't where it should have been, primarily, particularly, I should say, when the economy was weaker and we had the collapse. Folks were put in a real crunch and they just needed to get through that tough period. But that program has, which I authored and was passed into law, the state received money, has already been credited with creating over 9,000 jobs across Michigan. Now, however, those resources are out being deployed. Some of them will be coming back over time, but I've introduced legislation to expand the program, to put more money into the program. And it's should be one that we could get some pretty good traction on because it's a success, and we know it's a success. It's working, and it's working not just here in Michigan. It's working in states all across the country. It has shown that states, and states are the ones that control it, they know the areas where they need to focus on some business development and have the resources to make it happen.
And small businesses, they're our backbone here in for our economy because, Michigan Tech is our largest employer. We've got a couple of hospitals, but, we seem to be lacking a Ford plant. Of course, we have a long history of mining and other things, but manufacturing, those kind of, major employers, the Fortune 500 companies that will employ 300 people, we lack that up here. So if you work here, if you're not working for the hospitals or for the university, you are working for a small business.
Right. Absolutely.
And we'll share a lot of times when funding comes through the state or through federal means for the MEDC, the SBA. So we know that those things help. It's the stuff that goes on behind the scenes to make those programs available so that they can then make the capital available for the small business investors. That's what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly right. And without that, it is very tough. And, there's also been a challenge in some of the financing because we've seen more and more concentration of banking in very large institutions. A large bank isn't going to necessarily have the presence here in Houghton Hancock or in Marquette or Escanaba or other places. And so it's our smaller community banks that need to be supported because they're the ones that are in our community. And some of these resources, some of these things, when you're dealing with the SBA and others, provide the resources necessary for some of our smaller community banks to have the resources that they need in order to help small businesses.
Now, some would say that the government sometimes does a little bit too much when it comes to helping small business. Perhaps there is such a sort of thing, but are we anywhere near that?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I still think we can do more to do that, and that's why I'm certainly working to continue to make sure that credit is available for them. Small businesses are often kind of in a difficult situation as they're getting started. It's a precarious time for them to get started, and so any additional help that you can give is good for our community.
Any entrepreneur knows about the valley of death. It's that initial time where you're starting up your company, but you're yet to start producing a profit because there's just so much that goes into just getting the things going. So unless you have a whole bunch of money to start off with, getting going to in order to start turning that profit, a lot of companies, good companies, companies that could have had a bright future, don't make it out of that initial 1 to 3 year period sometimes without the influx of capital. And then we never see them and we never see the jobs that they potentially could have created.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, and that's why actually when I was in Marquette, I was with Black Rock's brewery because I'm working on a bill to reduce the excise tax for craft brewers. Here's an example. Small business people who are coming up, the folks that I met in Marquette, they started brewing beer in their garage or their basement, I think, and then now they've turned it into a successful company. It's selling beer not only throughout the UP but throughout Michigan with hopes to expand it elsewhere. And creating good jobs, paying jobs here in the UP. But there's the excise tax on beer is certainly a drain for them in the short run. So the legislation helps smaller craft brewers on quantities of 60,000 gallons or less to basically cut that excise tax in half. And they talked about it at our event in Marquette, how this will mean that they can put a little additional production facilities. And if they had that, they would be hiring more folks as well as they expand their operation. So it's those things that we do to help the smaller companies. Now, it'll be there for the big brewers. They're going to be paying the tax to pay for the bills for our schools and roads and everything else. But if we can give a little extra help to those entrepreneurs as they're first starting their businesses or first bringing that product online, that's good. And the great thing about the craft brew industry for us here in Michigan, this is a growing business. We're number six in the country in terms of that, is it not only creates local jobs in the community, it also attracts tourism. People are now looking for craft brews as they travel around areas. But also has the opportunity to expand some of our agricultural sector here in Michigan. We're in the perfect area geographically to grow hops, and a lot of folks who go to a local craft brewery would love to have Michigan hops, Michigan ingredients in that local brew. And so it's an opportunity for our farmers to grow hops, another cash crop. We're seeing more and more of those farms come up, and it's going to mean even more jobs. So helping a small industry, a small business like craft brewers is an example of how we help a small business when it's getting started, give a little bit of extra help as they're making investment into their business and into their employees.
We have a number of small breweries here in our area, too, that we're particularly proud of. And I know you stopped at in Marquette taking a look at that, and I imagine if you came here and started visiting more breweries too, your colleagues might wonder what you were doing on your trip here.
Well, I'll tell you, I plan to do that next time I'm here. I'm going to check out some more. So I work on that. I'm also working on the same sort of concept for our micro distilleries, which is also a really growing business, and I'm sure you have those around here too. So yeah, that's one of the best parts of the job. As I travel around the state, I can check out some great small businesses like micro distilleries and breweries.
We have something coming up in the works. They said they hope to be bottling by the end of this year, doing hard cider and using local apple crop, which they say would be, you know, a lot different than what you might be used to towards, you know, the big commercial products, because they use a very kind of a sweet apple. Our apples here, you know, they're not really pull off the tree and eat apples. They have a very, very tart flavor. Well, apparently it also makes a very good hard cider. So up here in Hancock here, they plan to be in operation for next year. So looking forward to that as well. I don't know if they fall in that window of that legislation, but if they did, I'm sure it helps them.
Yeah, actually, it does. It's going to be micro breweries for beer, distilleries, and cider as well. So it's part of it. You're exactly right. It's kind of these growing businesses that we're seeing pop up around the country and really creating quite an exciting local product that people are proud of. And, and consumers are now demanding a more craft product as they enjoy a beverage.
Well, you also focus a lot on Michigan waterways and our environment. Of course, we're very conscientious of that in this area. We've seen what poor stewardship can do to an environment, and so I'm glad to see that that's been a change of focus for us here over the last few decades. Talk about what your focus on the Great Lakes waterways and shorelines.
Well, I am, and that's in our DNA as a Michigander. We believe passionately in the Great Lakes, and we'll fight to make sure that they stay great for many generations to come. I share that passion, so I work on Great Lakes issues on a regular basis. I've just recently introduced some legislation that will be helpful for our waterfront communities, which will help them design programs to more effectively use waterfront, which is also something we have a lot of here in Michigan, with a lot of waterfront communities, and an opportunity to make sure that they are healthy. But the one area, too, that I've been spending some time on, and actually it's related to one of the committees that I serve on, which is the Commerce Committee, we have oversight of pipelines, and I've been concerned about some of the oil pipelines that exist in the Great Lakes. I know there's certainly a great deal of concern about the pipeline across the Straits of Mackinac and what that potentially could mean if anything should happen to it. You know, those of us in Michigan, we know what happens with a pipeline break and how catastrophic it can be, from what we saw in Kalamazoo just 5 years ago. That pipeline break was the most. So I think right now it's the most expensive pipeline break in the history of the country on land. Over $1 billion have been spent on the cleanup on the Kalamazoo River. And here was an example of a pipeline that was leaking oil. The company didn't know it. It was a utility worker, not affiliated with the pipeline company, a utility worker driving by saying, you know, I think this looks bad, and called the company, and it was 17 minutes after the break occurred before it was finally shut off. And then there we have a $1 billion price tag to clean it up. So you can imagine what would happen if we had a pipeline break underneath the Straits of Mackinac into the Great Lakes. It would be absolutely catastrophic. And so we need to look at make sure those regulations are in place to safeguard that. We have the federal agency that's responsible for oversight of pipelines is coming up for reauthorization in my committee this fall. And I'm going to be actively engaged in that issue to make sure that we're protecting our lakes.
And it's not meant to be anti-energy or anti-oil. No. It's the, you know, the fact that, like you said, what happened in the Kalamazoo River, we would not want to see floating on the shores of Mackinac Island.
No. And then, you know, and you think about a pipeline break in the Straits to different, or what could be very catastrophic, is what would happen if that happened in the wintertime when it's all covered with ice? How do you clean up a pipeline break in water, underneath the water, when it's all covered with ice?
Very interesting. No, I never thought about that. Well, on energy, we'll talk about energy a little bit because the UP, of course, is we've had our faces. We've faced our problems with energy up here. It's not very easy for us to get supply. It's really went up in the air over the last year. It finally seemed to kind of calm down and settle down a little bit, at least where we're going to get our power from. I don't know how familiar you are with that continuing struggle. But as somebody that, you know, I'm sure would be a promoter of renewable energy, alternative fuels, what do you see as our future here?
Well, there's no question we have to address that. The power costs are much higher here in the UP than other places, and that's an impediment to economic growth. The folks are looking to locate someplace. So the price of energy is a key factor in that. So it has to be addressed here for us in the Upper Peninsula. And, you know, it's interesting, actually, yesterday when the earlier meeting that I had this week when I was in Marquette, with the forestry roundtable, we were talking about the industry, and many folks were talking about biofuels and the burning of wood to generate power through biofuels plants. I mean, obviously, that's a great opportunity for us in the UP. There's an awful lot of that resource here. It was also quite clear that some of the resources that are in our national forest here in the Upper Peninsula can be harvested. The studies have been put in place. In fact, they were saying the investment of you need to have people who supervise that, and so there's some budget issues from the Forest Service, and yet if you pay them to supervise it, you're generating even much more money because you're harvesting this resource. And by harvesting the resource, it's also going to help things like the deer population and other things, which is great for recreational hunting and other things that are so important for us here in the UP. So, you know, that is certainly in one example of how we can diversify the energy in the UP while using UP resources and putting a lot of people to work in good paying jobs.
My understanding of the President Obama's Clean Power Plan, where I know a lot of people are, you know, they're taken back about, you know, the requirement for 30% of renewable energy coming by 2030, I believe it's off the top of my head. But it almost seems tailor-made for our area because,
yeah, it does, yeah.
I mean, if anybody's going to see a boom from that, it would be an area that has large access to renewable sources.
Absolutely. Yes. And that's what we need to take a look at. There's no question the UP is well positioned to be part of those kinds of solutions. And in Michigan, you know, we have a very diverse power mix now. We're continuing to expand that. Wind energy, for example, particularly with our location with the lakes. The lakes generate a pretty constant wind, which is great for wind energy. In the Thumb of Michigan, for example, you'll see a lot of windmills right now. The other thing that I think most people find interesting and don't know is that Michigan's one of the leading producers of solar cells in the country.
No, didn't know
that. You don't think of that as we tend to be a cloudy state, but actually a leading producer, Dow Chemical, in fact, you know, old world chemical company, but they're one of the leading solar producers in the world, and they're building things like solar shingles that look just like pretty close to the shingles you have on your house right now, but they're solar. They generate power for your house as opposed to the panels that we've seen in the past, and that's going to start transforming how we generate power. And those are being installed in Michigan homes and are efficient and can bring down the need for outside power pretty dramatically. And these are things that are happening in Michigan. They're Michigan jobs are being created in building the product. When you put in solar on roofs, you put people to work. You can't outsource that. Nobody in China can put the roof on your house. Those are Michigan workers that are doing it. So they're good paying jobs here in our state. And it's part of that diversified energy mix. But certainly here in the Upper Peninsula, all the above work, but you also have this biomass or resource too that we need to fully utilize.
Now, real quick, since we've got about a minute to go, talk about what's coming up for you in the near term.
Well, in the near term, I'm continuing to work on actually dealing with the auto industry and intelligent vehicles, vehicle-to-vehicle communications. It's the new frontier for autos, where our cars are going to start talking to each other and talk to the highways. In fact, I just put legislation in for sensors in roads to talk to vehicles. And the exciting thing about it, I don't have a lot of time to get into it, but you know, it's estimated the technologies that are coming online right now when it comes to vehicle, vehicle-to-infrastructure, in the next few years, they believe we can eliminate up to 80% of all car crashes in this country. It's pretty exciting. And when you think this is, we have 30,000 people who die on our highways every year in the United States. If we can eliminate 80% of crashes, that's a big deal.
Sure is. Look forward to an update on that next time you're my guest.
Well, thank you so much. Great to be with you.
All right. Copper Country Today. We'll be right back.